So this is 2007, Srila Prabhupada's disappearance. Some reading from Lilamrita about Prabhupada's life in New York before in the early days. Prabhupada lived in the Bowery, which is a very poor part of New York City, part of Manhattan. Sitting under a small light, while hundreds of drunks and derelicts sat under the street lights outside on the sidewalk. Prabhupada had no more fixed income than the derelicts, nor any greater security of a fixed residence. Yet Prabhupada's consciousness was different. Prabhupada was translating Bhagavatam into English, speaking to the world through his Bhaktivedanta purports. His duty, whether he was on the 14th floor of a riverside apartment building or in a corner of a Bowery loft. In other words, he was staying for a short time in uptown Manhattan by Central, it's called Central Park West. I have some familiarity with New York. I visited there and lived there sometimes. And this is where Yogi Mishra lived. And it was Prabhupada had some acquaintance with him. He was a Mayavadi, Advaitin yogi, although he was favorable. He lived there and Prabhupada stayed a short time with him, and then he said, well, this is not working out so well. Swamiji, maybe you should stay in the YMCA. So he sent him to the local YMCA, and then Prabhupada would come there to cook his lunch and also lecture at night, almost the same as Butler. So Prabhupada had become very accustomed to living in YMCAs, starting with Butler, then later in Manhattan. Dense, and this time was the winter time, so the smoke room was full of smoke and people. Oh, it's unbelievable. You can't imagine. So wherever he was, and then he stayed with some crazy guy in this loft, this artist's loft in the Bowery, and the downstairs it was like a factory, and then there would be open space on the top, storage space. So he stayed in one corner there with some crazy guy, David. So Prabhupada, as Prabhupada once said to his friends when he's moving down to the YMCA, that's really down. You're living, just imagine, it's like he was living in a penthouse apartment, which means the most costly suite on the top of the building, the top floor. You know, very costly suite with this Indian yogi, Mishra. Very posh and opulent, costly, beautiful apartment. He went from there to YMCA, and then he went from there to the Bowery. The Bowery is like, it's like going from Swargaloka to Patalaloka. And the Bowery is like Patalaloka. It's really a hell. All drug addicts and drunks lying on the street and terrible place and dirty. Oh, it's terrible. I've seen it. I know it. I've seen it with my own eyes. So when Prabhupada, some of his friends from uptown, from the Mugamishu's place, they said, how do you find the Bowery? And Prabhupada said, everywhere is my home. So he wasn't, didn't really matter. Life in the forest, and then this is just a Satsu saying. The Bowery loft where Prabhupada was holding his meetings and performing kirtan was also transcendental. In other words, when he moved to the Bowery, he was having his own classes there. He wasn't giving class in Yogi Mishra's place because he was restrained over there somewhat. When he was behind the partition which separated his part of the room from David's, he worked in a corner before the Bhagavatam. For Prabhupada, that room was as good as his room in Radhadamodar in Vrindavan. When everyone heard that Swami had moved to the Bowery, all the local hippies began to come by in the evenings and chant with him. The musical kirtans were very popular, and Swami's new congregation consisted mostly of musicians and artists who were more interested in music than philosophy. Every morning, Prabhupada would hold Srimad Bhagavatam class attended by David, that's the guy he lived with, Robert Nelson, another boy. The three guys were in Prabhupada's class. And occasionally, Prabhupada would teach cooking to whoever was interested. Prabhupada was usually available for personal talks with anyone who came, or with his new roommate. Imagine what mercy they were getting. Prabhupada's living with you. And although Prabhupada and his roommate David had each had a designated personal living area, the entire place soon became dominated by Prabhupada's preaching activities. In like a needle, out like a plow. Prabhupada was in one corner, and this other guy was in, took up most of the apartment with his painting and whatnot, whatever he was doing over there. Prabhupada and David got along quite well. At first, Prabhupada considered David to be an aspiring disciple. When David first came to the Bowery, he appeared like a clean-cut college student. He was 21 years old, 6 feet tall, blue-eyed, handsome, intelligent. Most of his new friends in New York were older, and they considered him a kid. His mother was paying $100 a month to lease the loft. Although he didn't have much experience, he was heading fast and hazard into the hazardous world of LSD. When he met Swamiji, that came at a time of radical change, and it profoundly affected his life. David is interviewed, and David said this. It was a really good relationship I had with the Swami, but I was overwhelmed by the tremendous energy of being that close to him. It spurred my consciousness very fast. Even my dreams at night would be of vivid Krishna consciousness. I was often sleeping when the Swami was up, because he was up late in the night working on his translations. That's possibly where a lot of consciousness and dreams just flowed in, because of that deep relationship. It also had to do with studying Sanskrit. There was a lot of immediate impact with the language. The language seemed to have such a strong mystical quality, the way he translated it word for word. Prabhupada's old friend from uptown continued to visit him when he moved downtown to the Bowery. He was impressed by Prabhupada's friendly relationship with his roommate, David. He saw that David was learning many things from the Swamiji. Mr. Robert, as Prabhupada called him, the man's name was Robert Nelson. Prabhupada often had a habit of this. His son's name was Mr. Joe Smith. Prabhupada called Mr. Joe. He bought a small American-made hand organ, something like a harmonium, and he gave it to David for chanting with Prabhupada. At 7 in the morning, Mr. Robert would come by, and after Bhagavatam class, he would talk with Prabhupada, telling his ideas for making records and selling books. It's really detailed. It's amazing how much detail. And all these details are not imagined. They're all researched. Because I worked for 2 years on this Leelamrita, on volume 5 and 6, researching for 5 and 6. And I interviewed 250 devotees and people in Bombay. And my field was, I've interviewed in Vrindavan, Bombay, and London, and Scotland, and the Manor. 250 interviews. It's like dragging. Anyway, it's a long story. But it's really, these details are all quite backed up. Mr. Robert wanted to help the Swamiji. They would sit in chairs near the front window, and Mr. Robert would listen to Prabhupada talk for hours about Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. Can you imagine? Sitting with Prabhupada for hours? New people began coming to see Prabhupada on the Bowery. Bowery means there's this area. Mr. Carl, a 30-year-old black man from the Bronx, he had attended Cornell University. Now he was studying Zen Buddhism and Indian religion. He had experimented with drugs, which he called psychedelic tools. He had an interest in music and poetry of India. He was influential among his friends and tried to interest them in meditation. He had even been dabbling in Sanskrit. Just see the kind of people like this. David was also studying Sanskrit. The very roommate that Prabhupada roomed with was studying Sanskrit. And this guy, this black guy drops in, he's also dabbling in Sanskrit. I mean, these are not ordinary hippies. Obviously, they have some connection with India from last life. Now they meet probably their Prabhupada's disciples. Carl had just finished reading a book called The Wonder That Was India. I said, oh, this is his personal saying now, the black person is speaking. I had understanding of what a sannyasi and brahmachari were. So that sannyasi wore a saffron robe. So when I saw Prabhupada like that, it made some impression on me. One night I was going to visit Michael Grant, that's Mukunda, to smoke some marijuana and sit around and play some music. All right. So I was going to his house, but somehow I took a wrong turn and I went down, and then I I intended to go to his house, but I went another way, and then I bumped into the Swami. And all of a sudden, as I passed, I saw it was Swamiji knocking on the door, trying to gain entrance. There were two bums hunched up against the door. It was like a two-part door. One of them was sealed, the other was locked. The two bums, which means drunkards and derelicts, they were lying on either side of Swamiji. One of these men had actually expired, which often happened, and you had to call the police or health department to get them. There were two guys lying on either side of the front door of Swamiji's apartment. One was dead, a dead bum, a dead human being, and the other guy was half dead. I don't think I saw the men lying in the doorway until I walked up to Swamiji and asked him, when I saw his orange robes, which I had read about, "Are you a sannyasi?" And he answered, "Yes." We had a conversation about how he was going to start a temple, and he mentioned Lord Chaitanya and the whole thing. He just came out with this flow of strange things to me right there in the street. But I knew that Swami was talking something important, because I read this book about any religion. I knew that this was a momentous occasion for me, and I wanted to help the Swami. We banged on the door, and eventually we got into the loft. David let us in. He invited me to come for kirtan, and I came back later that night for my first kirtan. And that became a fairly regular thing. And I stayed, at one point, the Swami asked me to stay with him. And I stayed for about 2 weeks. Probably was really merciful. Imagine he's inviting all these hippies, "Come on, live here, stay with me. I'll teach you Krishna consciousness." These drug addicts and LSD freaks. It's one thing, like, give a class, yes, become Krishna conscious, and then go, now get lost, you know. But no, live with me, sleep with me, I'll feed you, I'll teach you. Unbelievable. So then Prabhupada started teaching him Sanskrit. It was perhaps because of Carl's interest in Sanskrit that Prabhupada began holding Sanskrit classes. Interesting, huh? Carl and David and a few others would spend hours learning Sanskrit from Srila Prabhupada. I don't even remember this part. Using a chalkboard, Prabhupada taught the alphabet, and his students wrote their exercises in a notebook, just like India, they use a chalkboard. Prabhupada would look over their shoulders to see if they were writing correctly and would review their pronunciation. Ka, 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 ka. Da, 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 da. Can you imagine? I don't remember reading this. I don't remember. I don't know if you do, but I don't really personally remember that Prabhupada personally taught Sanskrit to a group of hippies in New York. I don't, you know. I didn't realize the extent of Prabhupada's involvement with the people. His students were learning not simply Sanskrit, but instructions on Bhagavad Gita, just like Lord Chaitanya was teaching Sanskrit, and all the dhatus meant Krishna. Each day he would give them a verse from Gita to copy in the Sanskrit language, Devanagari, translate into Roman alphabet, and then translate word for word into English. But eventually their interest in Sanskrit waned, and Prabhupada gradually gave up the daily classes to spend time on his own translations. Oh, these guys are, forget it. They can't learn it. His new friends may have regarded these lessons as Sanskrit classes, but actually they were classes in bhakti. Prabhupada did not come to America to teach Sanskrit. He came to distribute Krishna consciousness. But because he found some interest in some of the young people to investigate Sanskrit, he encouraged it. As a youth, Lord Chaitanya also started a Sanskrit school, which we know about then. So, now let's see, there's one guy came and he's saying, Prabhupada used to cook with us in the kitchen, and he was always aware of everyone else's activities in addition to his own cooking. He knew exactly how things should be done. He washed everything, made sure everyone did everything correctly. Prabhupada was a teacher. He used to make chapatis by hand, like Vrindavan Rajbasi style. And then one day he asked me to get him a rolling pin. I brought my rolling pin, and he appropriated it. Appropriated me, and he took it. Well, this is very nice. I can use this. Thank you. Prabhupada put some men on rolling chapatis and supervised them very carefully. I made chutney for Prabhupada at home. Can you imagine? He's a straight guy, not initiated anybody. He's Carl Becker. And then he says, Prabhupada always accepted our gifts graciously, although I don't think he ever ate any of them. That's the clincher. Perhaps he was worried we might put in something that wasn't allowed on his diet. He used to take things from me and put them in a cupboard. I don't know what he finally did with them, but I'm sure he didn't throw them away. I never saw him eat anything I prepared, although he accepted everything. This is a pretty standard modus operandi. Like so many people cook things. Maharaj, I made this for you. And my mother made these things. Oh, very good. Thank you. Very good, very good. And I accept it gladly, and I distribute it to all the kids in the neighborhood. These Brijvasis can digest everything. Prabhupada held his evening meetings on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, just as he did uptown. The loft was out of the way for most of his old acquaintances because it was on the Bowery, and they wouldn't want to come there anyway. A cluster of sleeping derelicts, which means drunks, regularly blocked the entrance to Prabhupada's apartment, and visitors would have a difficult time. They would have to step over as many as half a dozen bums before entering the entrance to Prabhupada's apartment. Then they would have to climb up 4 flights of stairs. Imagine stepping over, and some of those bums may be dead. Step over 1 or 2 dead bodies and 3 or 4 drunks, and finally get to the front door. It's like an obstacle course. So people said, well, okay, I don't think I'm going to go see the Swami. You had to be really determined to go before the class. Although it was something new, you could go and sit with a group of hip people and watch the Swami lead kirtan. The room was dimly lit, and Prabhupada would burn incense. Many casual people came and went. One of them was Gunther. So here's what Gunther had to say. The room was quiet and filled with incense. Everyone was talking in hushed tones, not really talking at all. Swamiji was sitting in front of the room and in meditation. There was a tremendous feeling of peace, which I never felt before. I studied for 2 years to become a minister. I was into meditation, but this was the first time to do anything Hindu or Eastern. There were a lot of pillows around the room and mats on the floor for people to sit on. I don't think there were any pictures. It was just Swamiji, incense and mats, and obviously the respect of the people in the room for him. So that's interesting. Even though whatever the people were, the young people had respect for Prabhupada. Because of his age, his stature, his influence, his knowledge, just being Indian, whatever, that was a good thing. They respected him. Before we went up, Carl was laughing and telling how Swamiji wanted everyone to use the hand symbols correctly. I never played symbols before. I just tried to follow Swamiji, who was doing it in a certain way. Things were building up, the sound was building up, but then someone was doing it wrong. And then Swamiji very, very calmly shook a finger at someone. And they looked, and then everything stopped. He instructed this person from a distance, and this fellow got the right idea, and then they started up again. Hey! No, look. 1, 2, 3. Okay, let's go. Everybody, okay, go. Hare Krishna! So, after a few minutes, the sound of the cymbals and the incense, we were not in the Bowery any longer. We started chanting Hare Krishna. That was my first experience in chanting. Of course, you know, maybe Catholics have their Hail Marys. But that's not quite the same thing as Hare Krishna. Hail Mary. It was relaxing and very interesting to chant, and I found Swamiji very fascinating. The loft was more open than Prabhupada's previous place uptown, so there was less privacy. And here some of the visitors were skeptical and even challenging. Everyone found Prabhupada confident and joyful. Prabhupada seemed to have far-reaching plans, and he had dedication. He knew what he wanted to do and was single-handedly carrying it out. It is not one man's job, he said. But he went on doing all he could, depending on Krishna for the results. His roommate David was starting to help, and more people were coming to visit Prabhupada. Almost all of Prabhupada's friends in the Bowery were musicians. They were into music, drugs, women, and spiritual meditation. Because Prabhupada's presentation of the Hare Krishna mantra was both musical and meditative, they were automatically interested. Prabhupada stressed that all Vedic mantras were sung. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita means the song of God. Because they're all in the music and singing. So he said, hey, well, that's what I'm teaching, singing and music. But the words of the Vedic hymns were incarnations of God in the form of transcendental sound. The musical accompaniment of hand cymbals, drum and harmonium was just that. An accompaniment had no spiritual purpose independent of the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Carol, this is somebody that we used to visit, she said, it was a very interracial, that means black people, white people, Spanish people, Mexican, Chinese, French, English, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, a music-oriented scene. It was music-oriented. There were a few professional musicians, and a lot of people enjoyed playing and just listening. Some people were painting in some of the nearby lofts, which means apartments. That was basically what was going on. We had many memorable kirtans. One day there was a beautiful ceremony. Some of us went over early in the morning to prepare for it. Hundreds of people came that day. I suppose it was initiation. But for the Bowery crowd, sound was spirit, and spirit was sound, in a merging of music and meditation. That's quite a good sentence. But for Prabhupada, music without the name of Krishna was not meditation, it was sense gratification, or at most, a kind of stylized, impersonal meditation. But he was glad to see the musicians coming to play along in his kirtans, to hear him and to chant responsively. Some, having stayed up all night playing somewhere on their instruments, would come by in the morning and sing with Swamiji. Oh, glory to Purita Valley of Krishna. Prabhupada did not dissuade them from their focus on sound. Rather, he gave them sound. Sound is the first element of material creation. The source of sound is God, and God is eternally a person. Prabhupada's emphasis was on getting people to chant God's personal transcendental name. Whether they took it as jazz, folk music, rock, or Indian meditation, it made no difference as long as they began to chant Hare Krishna. Carol. Whenever Prabhupada had the chanting, the people were fairly in awe of the Swami. A kind of transcendence came out of the ringing of the cymbals. Swami used the harmonium, and many people played hand cymbals. Sometimes he played the drum. In the very beginning, he stressed the importance of sound and the realization of God through sound. That was, I suppose, the attraction that these musicians found in him, the emphasis on sound as a means to attain transcendence in the Godhead. But he wanted a serious thing. He was interested in discipleship. So, it goes on like this. I think I might do, just for the next 10 minutes, is just read the actual personal memoirs. So this is Michael Grant, who was into music and studying music. He became later known as Mukunda. In his personal interview. The way Swamiji was dressed, he looked older and swarthy. But at the same time, there was an element of novelty. I was very curious. I didn't hear him talk when I first came. He was just chanting. Mainly, I was waiting to hear what he was going to say. I had already heard people chant before. I thought, why else would he put himself in such a place without any comforts, unless the message he's trying to get across is more important than his own comfort? I think the thing that struck me the most was the poverty that was all around him. This was curious, because the places that I had been before had been just the opposite, very opulent. There was the Vedanta Center in Upper Manhattan and others. And all these Indian yogis, and they lived in very posh and opulent settings. And probably just the opposite. They were these Vedantic and Indian societies in Manhattan and New York, they were filled with older men sitting in leather chairs with pipe tobacco. A kind of opulent environment. But this was real poverty. The Swamiji looked very refined, so it was very curious to me. What was he doing in such a place? When I finally talked to him, I realized he was a scholar and he spoke with great conviction. Some statements he made were very daring. He talked about God, and this was all new. to hear someone talk about God. I always wanted to hear someone I could respect talk about God. I always liked to hear religious speakers, but I measured them very carefully. When he spoke, I began to think, here is someone talking about God who may really have some realization of God. Swami was the first one I ever came across who might be a person of God who could really feel something deeply. After the kirtan, I went up to Swamiji. I had the same feeling I had had on other occasions when I met him, when I had been to hear famous people in concerts. I was always interested in going by after concerts to see musicians and singers, just to meet them and see what they were like. I had a similar feeling after Swami spoke, so I went and started talking. But the experience I got from Swamiji was different from the other people I had met, because Swamiji was not in a hurry. He could talk to me, whereas with others all you could do was get in a few words. They were more interested in something else. You know, you go to meet some musician, big musician. Okay, nice, how are you? That's fine. You play guitar? Okay, bye. But Prabhupada was a person who was actually showing interest in me as a person. And I was so overwhelmed that I ran out of things to say very quickly. I was surprised. Our meeting broke off on the basis of my not having anything further to say. It was just the opposite of so many other experiences where musical performers would be hurrying off to do something else. This time, I was the one who could not continue speaking. Prabhupada liked to take walks. Like, apparently, Prabhupada was walking way back in the 60s. From his doorstep at 94 in the Bowery, he would see directly across the street the Fulton Hotel, a 5-story flop house. That means where all prostitutes stay in. That's a terrible place Prabhupada was staying. Surrounding him were other lower Manhattan lodging houses where tenants wandered the sidewalks from early morning till dark. If you can figure out what that means. Tenants wandering the sidewalk. Do you know what that means? It means prostitutes. Flophouse means where prostitutes, a brothel, that they wander the sidewalk picking up customers from early morning until dark. It was a dark day going on. An occasional flock of pigeons would stir and fly from one rooftop to the next. Traffic was heavy. The Bowery was part of a truck route to and from Brooklyn. It was noisy, smelly, full of air pollution, full of prostitutes, drunkards, derelicts, bums, drug addicts. And that's where Prabhupada was staying and living and preaching. It's unbelievable. Prabhupada would walk alone in the morning through the Bowery neighborhood. Now it's this time of the book is describing the May. There's lots of rain. Prabhupada carried an umbrella. Sometimes he walked in the rain. He was not always alone. Sometimes he walked with one of his new friends and talked. Sometimes he shopped. He would buy bitter melon, Kerala, dal, hing, chickpea flour, and other specialty foods common in Indian vegetarian cuisine, which were available in Chinatown's nearby markets. He was happy to find that. He's buying hing in New York. On leaving his loft, he'd walk a few steps to Bowery and Hester Street, and like this, he would go to the Central Asian food market. In other words, Prabhupada went to some nice food markets and he found some fresh vegetables. And he describes just the scene where Prabhupada walked and all the different. Despite the bad neighborhood where Prabhupada lived and walked, he was rarely disturbed. Often he would find several Bowery bums asleep or unconscious at his front door. And he would have to step over them to go into his flat. Sometimes a drunk, out of his inability to maneuver, would bump into Prabhupada. Sorry. Excuse me. Here's a guy, just wait. Go in your parlor. Or sometimes a derelict would mutter something unintelligible or laugh at The more sober drunks would stand and gesture courteously, ushering the Swami into or out of his 94 Bowery. So some of the drunks and bums would be hanging around by Prabhupada's entrance, and when he would come in, they'd say, "Oh, Swamiji, right, go ahead, yes. Right, go right this way, Swamiji. going. Prabhupada would pass among the derelicts, acknowledging their good manners as they cleared the path. Of course, the Bowery bums, they didn't really know anything about this sadhu dressed in saffron, carrying an umbrella and a brown grocery sack. Now someone says, the girlfriend of Michael Grant. This is Janaki, later became Janaki. I would see Swamiji in the midst of this potpourri of people down there, walking down the street. Swami always had an umbrella, and he would always have such a serene look on his face, means peaceful. He would be taking his afternoon jaunts, walking along, sometimes stepping over the drunks. It's like an obstacle course, walking down the sidewalk. Oh, excuse me, boink, boink, step over the drunk. And I would always get sort of nervous when I would meet him on the sidewalk. He would say, "Are you chanting?" I would say, "Sometimes." Then he would say, "That's a good girl." Now this guy, Howard Smith, I don't know who he is, maybe that's Hayagriva, not sure. Once I went down there to the loft, I went upstairs in this very funky artist loft. Very funky. There were carpets all over the place, old and worn out and stinking. A lot of people were sitting around in various kinds of hippie garb. Plus, what I think they must have thought was Indian garb. Most of them were sitting alone around the room facing the wall. Highballs. They're really flying on something. They're facing the wall, like they had nothing to do with each other. Can you imagine going into a room, there's 20 people, everyone's sitting facing the wall?
Going through it.
They're really going to get merging with the wall. They were all sitting cross-legged, and each one seemed to be doing something different. And nobody paid any attention to me when I walked into the loft. I saw shoes lined up outside, and I thought, oh, maybe I'm supposed to take off my shoes. But nobody said anything to me. So I walked around the edge of the carpet looking for somebody to pay attention to me. I wondered, what the hell's going on? But I didn't want to interrupt anybody. Because they all seemed to be deep into whatever kind of prayers they were doing. In the back of the loft, which means apartment, I saw a little curtain, an Indian Madras-type curtain. So I decided to peek into that area. And there, sitting cross-legged in saffron garments, with markings on his nose and forehead, and his hand in a bead bag, I saw Swami Bhaktivedanta. Even though he looked like the real thing, he seemed more approachable. So I said, "Hello." And he looked up and I said, "Swami Bhaktivedanta?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm Howard Smith." I was expecting to sit down, so I said, "Excuse me, I have to take off my shoes?" And then Swamiji said, "Why do you want to take off your shoes?" Prabhupada's so accommodating. He's standing there in front of Prabhupada, inside his bed, inside his private apartment, inside his room, inside his private quarters, standing with shoes on. He said, "Oh, do I have to take off my shoes? Oh, why do you want to do that?" Prabhupada's so humble, so undemanding. Like now it's somebody, "Hey, why are your shoes? Why are you doing your shoes on?" You go in some ISKCON temple, you know, new guy comes in, he doesn't know. "Hey!" And you get a stick and they start to beat the guy. I've seen regularly. New Bhakta, some guy doesn't know, he inadvertently, unknowingly walks in with his shoes under the temple. Look at Prabhupada's reaction. He said, "Why do you want to take off your shoes?" And then Howard said, "Well, I don't know. I saw all those shoes out there." And Swami said, "I didn't ask you to take off your shoes." "I didn't ask you to take off your shoes." And I said, "Well, what are all those people doing out there?" And Swami said, "I don't know." and they don't know what they're doing either. I'm trying to teach them, and they seem to be misunderstanding me. They're very confused people. Then Swamiji and I sat and talked, and I liked him a lot right away. I mean, I met a lot of other Swamis. I think this is how I agree with. I met a lot of other Swamis. I didn't like them very much. And I don't think it's fair to lump them all together and say, those Swamis in India. That's not fair. But Swami was very, very basic, and that's what I seemed to like about him. He not only made me feel at ease, but he seemed very open and honest. Like he asked my advice on things, because he was very new in America. I liked his ideas. I thought Swami's ideas stood a good chance of taking hold, because he seemed so practical. His head wasn't in the clouds. He wasn't talking mysticism every third word. Like the other song, you could have mystic. By doing this transcendental meditation, you will have a mystical experience and feel an unlimited bliss within your heart. So you please join us. This is very mystical. And if you come with us and take part in this meditation, you will feel the supreme mystic experience. So every other word is mystic. People say, wow, Swami Satchitananda. Only $35.
For the mantra.
For the secret mantra. I'm... That's the mantra they give everybody.
Bijan.
So Swami, he wasn't speaking mysticism. I guess that is where his soul was at. But that isn't where his normal conversational consciousness was at. Then he said... one local paper gave a good write-up about him. And I said I thought what he was doing was correct. He asked me if I had read any books or knew anything about Indian culture. I said, no, not really. We talked a little. He explained to me that he had those books in English he already translated. And he handed those to me and said, if you want more background, you can read these. It was obvious to me that I was not talking to some fellow who just decided that he had seen God and was going to tell people about it. Swamiji seemed to be an educated man, much more than myself, actually. And I liked his humbleness. I just plain liked the guy. He explained everything I wanted to know, the significance of what he was wearing, the mark on his forehead, the bead bag, and I liked all his explanations. Everything was very practical. Then he talked about temples all over the world. Bravo, it's like he's sitting in this loft with all these nutcases, and he has no money, no followers, no disciples, and nothing. And he's saying, yes, I'll have temples all over the world. Everything was very practical. Then he talked about, he said, well, we have got a long way to go, but I am very patient. The Prabhupada told this new person, Howard Smith, yes, I want to establish Radha Krishna temples all over the world. Of course, we have a long way to go, but I'm very patient. This is one beat artist or hip artist. I was staying at Carl's loft, and one day Swamiji came strolling in one day. So I already knew he was on the scene from David's place. Mostly musicians were coming to the Swamiji. They were enjoying that private morning session with him. Morning, it's just a music. It's a, what do you call it? Jam session. Oh, hey man, you going down to the Swami this morning? Yeah man, yesterday went down. It's a good scene down there. Got the flutes, got the guitar, got the bongos and conga, triangles, hand cymbals. Wow, we be grooving down there, man. Come on down tomorrow morning. Yeah. Oh, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. it was like a wild scene. So they were enjoying that private morning session with the Swami. And that's really strange in itself. Because these people were already up all night. And then they used to do it at 6 in the morning for about an hour. They used to do it. Do it means do the Hare Krishna thing. Swami would lead them in the chanting with his hand cymbals. Dot, dot, da. Dot, dot, da. It was strange. Because that crowd was heavy into drugs. And they were well read. But for a short period, they used to go every morning, 9 or 10 of them. And they felt very good about it. They felt very good that they did that in the morning. Mangal Arati. they attended Mangal Arati. So this is what Swamiji was dealing with in New York. Then Carl says later, because for some time, actually, David went a little wild and tried to kill Swamiji, pulled a knife on him. So then Swamiji went to Carl's place and he stayed with Carl and his girlfriend and their dog. Srila Prabhupada, Swamiji moved from David's place because he took LSD and freaked out and came at it with a knife to kill Prabhupada. So he ran down the apartment and went to Carl's house. And Carl was staying with his girlfriend. He's a black guy with a white girlfriend and a big dog. So he probably moved there with the three of them. So now this is the scene. Now he's down there. Carl said, I couldn't really see my apartment turn into a temple because I was raising cats and dogs. He had cats and dogs in his apartment. And Swamiji kept saying I should remove them. So Prabhupada was living in this apartment with his black guy and his white girlfriend and five or six cats and dogs, and the guy was a meat eater. But he had nowhere else to go, no other shelter. Prabhupada used to call me a meat eater, but then he changed our diet. Of course, he was hitting the American culture, which doesn't know what all this business is. I have to put it on myself as much as anyone. I can understand and absorb India through an impersonal agency like a book or record. But there he was, a living representative of Godhead, living in my own living room. To me, it was difficult as anything I've ever had to do before or since. In other words, it was really austere for him to try to live with Prabhupada. Now, what about Prabhupada's viewpoint? You imagine what... Then there's something... Michael Grant says, I was awakened one morning very early, and Carl was on the phone saying, listen, Swamiji and I were just taking a walk, and we thought we'd come up to see you. But I said, but it's too early in the morning. And he said, well, Swamiji wants to see you. They were very nearby, just down the street, so I had to get quickly dressed. And by the time I got to the door, Swamiji and Carl were standing there waiting to meet me. I was unprepared, but I invited them up to my apartment. The television had been on all night from the previous night, and there were some cartoons on the TV. Swamiji sat between Carl and me on the couch. I was keeping a pet cat, and the cat kept jumping on Swamiji's lap. And he abruptly knocked it off on the floor. We began to talk. Imagine Swamiji sitting between these two hippies, Michael on one side, Carl on the other side. They're both drug addicts and hippies. Just both of them had stayed up all night watching television. And now, Michael's watching Looney Tune cartoons, early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and this cat's jumping all over Swamiji. We began to talk, but Swamiji glanced over at the cartoons on the TV and said, this is nonsense. Suddenly I realized that I forgot the TV was on, and that it was nonsense. And I got up very quickly saying, yes, it is nonsense, and turned it off. So then they had a whole discussion. Carla was saying that, my girlfriend can't get along with the Swamiji and the cats and dogs can't get along with Swamiji. So maybe you can find another place for the Swamiji. So eventually all this led to the renting a storefront, and that's how it started.